Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome Doug Scott. He's the policy director for the Campaign for America's Wilderness, and he's the author of several books, including The Enduring Wilderness and Our Wilderness, America's Common Ground. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So we've talked about wilderness on this program before, but I think it's really important to start with making some distinctions. What is the difference between among the various kinds of public land, wilderness and national parks and BLM land and things like that?
Well, we Americans are so fortunate because about a third of our landscape is still owned by all of us through the federal government, about one third. Most in the West and in Alaska, but all across the country. And over the years, Congress has established a wide variety of conservation agencies, the National Park Service that looks after the national parks, of course, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management. Wilderness designation can apply to any of those, the lands administered by any of those four agencies. It's an extra level of protection, an extra layer of protection for areas that Congress itself chooses might be part of a national park, the part beyond the edges of the roads, that is given this extra level of protection, never to be developed, always to be the wilderness that park visitors come to see in national forest areas. The Gila Wilderness here in New Mexico is a good example of a wilderness area that Congress has established following earlier efforts by the U.S. Forest Service. It's part of a national forest, not all of it. It's this extra layer of protection. Collectively, all of the areas that Congress has chosen, there's now over 700 of them for this gold standard of nature protection, the highest form of protection we offer to our lands in our system. About 700 areas, just about 110 million acres of land, which sounds like a lot, but it's only about 4.7% of the total land area of the United States. And over half of that is in Alaska, and very large parks and refuges, wilderness areas in Alaska. So there's many areas that Congress, year in and year out, Republicans and Democrats, all the presidents since the Wilderness Act was signed have participated in encouraging this program, and this is ongoing work.
What happens and what doesn't happen in wilderness areas?
The biggest distinction is that in wilderness areas, the goal is to preserve the natural character of the landscape and to allow the forces of nature to unfold in their own way, the future of the wildlife and the ecosystems to unfold under as much as we can under natural forces. What you can't do in wilderness areas is build roads, harvest timber, drill for oil and gas unless you have a pre-existing claim, of which there aren't very many. So these are areas that are segregated from those kinds of uses in order to protect a different kind of use, the kind of quiet recreation that so many people seek. Grandparent taking a grandchild out for a exposure on a walk in a quiet forest.
Or camping.
Hunting and fishing in many of these areas are favorite pursuits. Nature photography, just loafing. Backpacking trips or just a day hike. There's such a rich diversity in our system of wilderness areas across the country that offers something for everyone. Most importantly, and a whole other category of purposes that for which these areas are set aside by Congress is to protect watersheds in order to have sources of clean water, to protect the crucial habitats for wildlife, including endangered species. But when you get down to fundamentals, I think the principal reason that we preserve wilderness areas is as our gift to future generations. The world they live in will be more frantic, more hectic than the world we live in. And the wilderness that they will have any chance to experience will only be those areas that we choose now to preserve for them. I suppose you could hypothecate that they might say, what was the matter with those people? They set aside all these areas as wilderness. They can change. If they in their Congress 100 years from now decide that's their choice, we're really just giving them the choice to know these wildest portions of our public lands.
How permanent is wilderness designation?
Well, it's as permanent as it can be in a democracy. And that's why the Wilderness Act was passed 45 years ago this week by Congress to give these areas this highest form of statutory protection. Once a wilderness area is designated, Congress has specified a particular boundary and the protections of the Wilderness Act, then only Congress can change that in the future. It's not easy to pass laws through Congress. But our founders designed it that way. So those of us who advocate the preservation of wilderness areas happily take on the burden of having to convince the Congress, case by case, that these areas merit this protection. Once Congress has enacted it, then that's as permanent a guarantee as you can have in a democracy.
Let's talk about some of these functions of wilderness areas. I think something that really should not be underestimated when people talk about land use is the provision of clean water to people. Why is it that you need a wilderness area to provide clean water?
I'm not sure that you could make the case that you absolutely have to, that only a wilderness area will protect the water quality in a river system, but it sure does the job. So I'm thinking of the mayor of a small town in the forests in West Virginia, who was in the White House this last March as President Obama signed a law protecting wilderness in the watershed of his community. And he was just thrilled to be there to see the finishing of this work that he and his city had so strongly wanted, because it was already national forest land, but they wanted the guarantee of wilderness protection for their watershed.
And that was all about ensuring water supplies for the future.
And ensuring stable supply, also ensuring the cleanliness of the water.
How does a wild area make the water clean?
The water isn't dirty. If in the best of all possible worlds, these streams that arise in the mountains that are protected in wilderness areas, they are coming from nature as clearly as any water can.
So basically it's avoidance of factories, developments, sewage, and all those things.
And too much human use that might, and kinds of human use in many kinds of soils, just building a road, for like a logging road, just the road itself will just unravel sediment into a stream. And in the part of the country where I live, in Washington State, this is a huge problem of old abandoned logging roads that are now pouring sediment into salmon spawning streams, fouling up the salmon spawning beds. Wilderness areas are sort of the gold standard for the protection of waters that are clean now and that we want to keep clean.
We're talking to Doug Scott with the Campaign for America's Wilderness. Another very important part is protecting wildlife, and I've often thought that in the same way that people in poor neighborhoods really don't have control over the world in which they live, animals also don't have control over the world in which they live. This is their home. Somebody can come in and put a building or a golf course or log it into oblivion or whatever. What are the reasons both, I mean, there's certainly protecting wildlife for its own sake, but also what are the human consequences of not protecting wildlife?
Well, this varies species to species, But there are some species of wildlife, grizzly bear, wolves, lots of kinds of bird life that are require extremely undisturbed habitat. And the least bit of disturbance can drive them away, and away may be someplace where they can't survive. So that the function of wilderness areas in providing a sanctuary for wildlife species is extremely important. The salmon, again,
Northwest?
In the country where I come from, the salmon come up the streams to spawn, and we have to protect those spawning beds, or the whole life cycle of the salmon is decimated. And four or five of the species are on the endangered species list now. We've had some real successes in this country in staving off extinction of threatened species. The California condor, a very good example. Crucial to that is protecting large, undeveloped swaths of their habitat for these wilderness-loving creatures.
And so endangered species are part of this whole conversation.
Absolutely.
I think, can you give some examples of species where if they're lost or if they move away, the ecosystem suffers?
There's a bird that lives in the high alpine country of at least as far south as Colorado. I don't know if they get into New Mexico, called the Clark's nutcracker. And this species is adapted perfectly to harvest the seeds from the cones of whitebark pine. Those pine cones don't release their seeds any other way. The Clark nutcracker harvests the seeds, it's a very sharp beak, stores the seeds in its cheek or under its tongue, flies down to disturbed soil far from the tree, and puts a little cache. They do thousands of these. They're just busily at it all day in this high alpine.
So it's like their equivalent of putting it in the pantry?
And they remember where they all are.
And then they come back and eat it later.
And they come back and eat it later, but they don't come back to all of it. And so that's how groves of whitebark pine reestablish themselves. The other creature that relies on the seeds from the cones that this bird has kicked out of the tree are grizzly bears. Lose the whitebark pine, which is happening now. We lose the Clark nutcracker. We lose the grizzly bears. This is a delicately evolved system into which we introduced just at the start of the 20th century, by mistake, a pathogen from the Far East came ashore. They know when it arrived in the port of Vancouver, British Columbia.
So basically,
and it
some
is spread,
human.
It wasn't here naturally. And these whitebark pine species are not adapted to survive this disease. And it's an open question right now in high timberland line country whether this whole system will unravel. And it's just, I've been to meetings with scientists just focused on that specific question, because it's as clear an example of a delicately evolved set of interrelationships. And what we did through so much of human history was in ignorance, act out of ignorance, and gum up the natural order of things. In wilderness areas, we're trying to save some samples of the original Earth, the original complex of species that have evolved in that place, and to let them just unfold their lives in the future. And it's the wildlife function is extremely important. Having said that, wilderness areas except in national parks are generally open for hunting, sport hunting, under state regulations, fishing. So there are many forms of recreation and photography. People are drawn to places with beautiful wildlife. The visitors that stop on the road in Yellowstone to watch the grizzly out in the vast meadow of the Lamar Valley didn't come to admire the road or the engineering of the turnout they parked on. They came to look at that wilderness species in its wilderness setting, just beyond the edge of the road. The function of this wilderness designation that Congress can confer to places like that is to protect that experience for future generations.
Getting back to the complex relationships inside of ecosystems, you know, that's the nutcracker bird spreading the seeds of this pine cone and so on. For every example like that, I imagine there are many more that science has not discovered yet. And so, you know, just because we haven't actually named them and figured out the pieces of this puzzle doesn't mean that we're not ruining 100 of those every time we log a forest.
Well, when I was a kid, school books, like arithmetic books, had the answers in the back. Somebody famously said about our wilderness areas that they're a place to answer the questions which we haven't yet looked at the back of the book for the answers. We don't know what we don't know. And
we don't even know all the questions.
We don't even know the questions. And it is simply prudent to say, let's set aside some reasonable portion, not all, some reasonable portion of our bounty of public lands to protect these values and to kind of kick the ball down the street a ways in terms of what will we discover in the future. What sources of crucial medicines, what genetic discoveries, questions we simply don't know how to formulate, things we don't yet know how to measure. Wilderness areas have a very important function as a kind of scientific benchmark. Here, as best we can, we're protecting the natural order of things. And that way we can compare how things unfold in that place relative to other places that we have developed.
There's a lot more wilderness and public land. I mean, leaving aside Alaska, which has a huge amount of wilderness designation, takes up a disproportionate amount of that designated. But even in the lower 48, we have a much, much, much larger amount of public land and wilderness in the west than in the east. Why is that?
Simply because there's so much more public land. The original 13 colonies were completely private land. They and other states that emerged in the Ohio Valley, very little public land. In fact, and then in the last years of the 19th century and early into the 20th century, the timber barons went through the eastern forests and just decimated them, cutting out the Great Lake states, the great white pine forests of the Lake states, and leaving behind huge slash, just cut over, horribly abused lands. Catastrophic fires followed, and in 1911, Congress passed a law that enabled the U.S. Forest Service to establish new national forests in the eastern states, which we the taxpayers purchased. So today there's a Green Mountain National Forest in Vermont and the White Mountain National Forest in New Hampshire and the Cherokee National Forest in Tennessee. Every acre had to be repurchased from private ownership.
Now, what were they repurchasing it from people who'd sort of raped the land and left it to...
In very large measures, these were lands that should never have been settled, should never... Another part of the lands that the Forest Service administers are called national grasslands. And these were lands that were in the Great Plains that were plowed, should never have been plowed, couldn't hold the soil, couldn't sustain farm families. And in the after the Depression, during the Roosevelt administration, they basically just purchased this to get these folks some cash and to retire these lands. A lot of this land is places that shouldn't have been ever developed. And because the price being paid in things we've talked about, in degradation of water quality, in decimation of wildlife species, in destruction of the what might have been a sustained forest for timber, you know, for reasonable timber production. So this was really a matter of coming back out after the horse was out of the barn and developing these areas in the more populous eastern states as national forests. And now Congress has returned to those places and designated portions of those lands as wilderness areas. There's one in New Hampshire that was designated in a law signed by George Bush 2 years ago called the Wild River Wilderness. And there was used to be a town there back in the time of the timber development.
Right.
And then the big fire in 1903 went through, and the timber was all cut out, and it was just abandoned. Became a part of the National Forest in the teens, and now this particular little valley is protected as a wilderness area. Clearly, it was disturbed at one time in the past, but the Wilderness Act was carefully drafted not to set so artificially pure a standard. This has to be land that was never touched
right.
by man, that nothing would qualify. And the man who crafted that careful definition of wilderness in the Wilderness Act was New Mexico's own former governor, former senator, the late Clinton Anderson, who is the father of the Wilderness Act in the United States Senate.
Interesting.
So this wilderness preservation business is not something that is being administered by, you know, Eastern elites or something of that kind to the detriment of the West. This was a law that was shaped by Westerners.
We're talking to Doug Scott, who is with the Campaign for America's Wilderness. One thinks of environmental degradation and deforestation and massive suburban development as being a kind of post-World War II phenomenon, but you're taking it back really to the 19th century.
There's threads that go way back. The world's first national park was invented by our country. That was in a law signed by President Grant in 1872. The Yosemite Valley was preserved in a law signed even earlier, 1864, signed by Abraham Lincoln. We don't normally think of, and then for another quite a few generations, the whole intent of public land management in our country was to get rid of it. So if you wanted to homestead, if you wanted to go and claim mineral claims, so there was a massive effort to develop the country. The railroads that crossed the Great Plains were built on the basis of land grants to the railroad companies. They received federal land free for nothing to encourage them to build the Union Pacific and the Northern Pacific and the other rail lines across the West. Only more recently, in the 1950s, so after World War II, did we finally reach a conclusion that not only were we going to hang on to our national parks and our national forests, but the vast lands administered by the Bureau of Land Management here in New Mexico and elsewhere in the West, that instead of just assuming these were lands just being held onto until we could get rid of them, that they should be saved. They had important conservation values, much greater recognition today of the ecosystem value of desert lands, of the wide variety of lands that we're fortunate enough to have in our public land heritage.
So when you have a big swath of land and then you cut it up with railroads and roads, and there are still big pieces of land, but they're chopped up in that way, what harm comes to them through that type of development?
This is a subject of considerable scientific study. It's a process of fragmentation. You take a block of 100,000 acres of land and you bisect it with a road. The road itself takes up very few acres. You basically still have two blocks, each of 50,000 acres, but you don't have an intact habitat. And where one road goes, in our history, the common pattern has been, let's put another and another. In this way, so many of our forested valleys, so many of our western desert plateaus have simply been transected by an increasing spider web of roads.
7 million miles worth of roads, is that it, in the U.S.?
Yes. And what we've got, the situation we now have on lands administered by the Bureau of Land Management and the National Forests, is way too many roads. I'm not talking about cutting off access of people. If they have private land, of course they have a right of access. I'm not talking about cutting off a variety of recreational uses. But we simply can't maintain the roads we have, and the environmental price that's being paid in muddying up and erosion into streams and the decimation of wildlife habitat, especially for sensitive species that can't take that kind of intense human presence. So we're having to go back now, and the new buzzword is road decommissioning on the national forest. We're going back and taking roads out.
How do you take roads out?
It's not easy. First of all, whatever the use they were put there for is over. And so one way that this is being done, and proposed legislation that's now before the Congress involves some areas in Montana, is there'll be some timber cutting. But as a part of this so-called stewardship timber contract, the company that goes in and does the selective logging of an area, as part of its contract, will take the road out, as they call it, rolling up the road as they leave, with the paradoxical result that there'll be more roadless land on some of those forests when this process is completed than there are today.
We're talking to Doug Scott. There's all this work being done in the United States, and of course, New Mexico borders on Mexico. What kind of international work are you involved in terms of preserving wilderness?
The Wilderness Act that Congress passed and President Johnson signed 45 years ago, on September 3rd of 1964, has become the model for countries around the world. Wilderness preservation efforts modeled closely on our Wilderness Act, but adjusted to local circumstances. Botswana, South Africa, New Zealand, the Russian Federation, countries around the world. And this November, the government of Mexico is hosting the 9th World Wilderness Congress. The last one was held in Anchorage 3 years ago. And this will be held in Merida in the Yucatan Peninsula, and will bring together several thousand people who are working, scientists, government officials, conservation group representatives from around the world to share ideas and talk about the practical details of nature protection and specifically wilderness protection.
Is preventing the acceleration of climate change part of that conversation?
Climate change is a part of every conversation where conservationists talk to each other these days. The severity of the changes that we predictably will see coming to our environment through the result of greenhouse gas emissions, and that will happen now, even if we act far more quickly and more decisively than we seem to be willing to act to reduce those emissions, it changes things in such fundamental ways. I think the commonly understood is the huge impact that this is having in the Arctic, where the Arctic ice flows are going to be a thing of the past. Glacier National Park, one of the great national parks in this country, won't have any glaciers. Just about don't anymore. These are changes which are occurring at a pace that the natural world may not be able to keep up with. Species may simply not be able to move fast enough or far enough as the climate changes around them.
Polar bears are a great example of that,
because they den in the shore ice. And if there's no shore ice, there's no denning, they hunt from the ice pack. If there's no ice pack, they're...
And they move on the ice flows.
And they move on the ice flows, exactly.
So the really big catastrophic consequences that we've already seen, and the potential catastrophic consequences of inaction or even just too slow action. Climate change is one of them. What else are you looking at?
The loss of habitat to development. I return again to the blessing that we Americans have to have this rich heritage of our public lands. It's much harder to deal with the problems of on private lands with private ownership, which is perfectly fine. The fact that we have this buffer of the federal lands, Nevada, one of our most urban states, is also 95% federal land.
I know. It's so weird when you look at a map of public land and Nevada is just like all colored in.
Except for two rather large cities.
Right.
The people of Nevada have been supporting the preservation of new wilderness areas there in recent years because they see that beyond the edge of their communities, there is the sanctuary of the public lands, and they want to see those preserved.
There is something that, I mean, you were talking earlier about life becoming more and more frantic. There is a reality, which is that we evolved in small bands of people, small, relatively small tribes, in the middle of nature. Would you say, for example, that what is now the United States, before Europeans ever got here, was 100% wilderness, even with the way it was used by Native people?
No, I wouldn't say that. Wilderness is, after all, a human idea, it is not possible to take man and man's impacts out of the equation. I think we're learning lots more about how Native peoples actually had a very, around the globe, had very profound impacts on their natural environment through the use of fire, deliberate fire, to move wildlife populations around and for one thing and another. There's not some absolute thing out there called wilderness. And boy, when you step over the line, that was wilderness and this other thing. This is a human idea. It is and it's now a legal idea in terms of some specific definitions that the Congress worked out for what these lands are for. But it's not something that you can separate from man. So many people have written of their experiences, Thoreau and Aldo Leopold and many others at Abbey, written about experiences in the wilderness. And one analogy that's fairly common is that after two or three days on the trail on a backpacking trip, you suddenly feel like a door is open and you've come home. And people seek a serenity that can't be had in places that are also open to offer vehicle driving, snowmobiles, the machinery of modern life. These are sanctuaries of quiet. They're tabernacles of solitude. This is such a popular idea. In 45 years, the Congress, year after year after year, has continued adding areas to the wilderness system. Very steadily, so that we started just 45 years ago with 9 million acres protected when the Wilderness Act itself was signed into law. Now it's over 109 million acres. And every acre got there only because our national board of directors, the Congress, voted to put it there. That's a very high standard. That's not something that is easily accomplished. And groups like the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society and my organization and lots of others who work to see this special form of protection for some lands are finding continued public support and continued bipartisan political support. When President Obama signed the most recent law that designated several million acres of wilderness area in nine states back in March, the crowd of members of Congress gathered around him, conservative Republicans, liberal Democrats, the whole gamut, all celebrating.
Well, the fact that it's good PR for them is also good for wilderness.
Absolutely. This is a popular program, and I could rattle off a lot of things from public opinion surveys, but the biggest public opinion survey of all is elections. And people who have worked to protect wilderness areas in their states, by and large, are well thought of.
We're talking to Doug Scott. He is with the Campaign for America's Wilderness. Have any wilderness areas been declassified, so to speak, as wilderness? I mean, Lord knows that there's been a lot of pressure on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in that regard.
Well, let me answer that in two parts. First of all, the answer is yes. Wilderness areas have been removed from designated wilderness areas. The man who conceived of the Wilderness Act and worked so closely with Senator Clinton Anderson and others in the Congress to see it enacted was a man named Howard Zonizer. He was the executive director of the Wilderness Society in those years, and he liked to respond. There's a common assertion, well, you're locking up these wilderness areas. And he said, sure, it's a lock, but it's got a key. And to that I add, we have to decide who gets to hold the key. And we've decided our elected board of directors, the Congress. There have been occasions, about a dozen, in which some kind of an error was made in the boundaries of a wilderness area that Congress designated, and it's caused some kind of practical problem. And by agreement with all the parties involved, they've gone back to Congress and had that area revised. But that's the only power to do that is in the Congress. And so it sets a high burden of proof to say this isn't some frivolous argument. One case involved clearly errors in the boundary map that caused some problems in a wilderness area near Logan, Utah. And in 2003, President Bush signed a law revising that to solve the problem, which our group supported, and the local people, the local jurisdictions. The law changed the boundary by 31 acres, but it took an act of Congress. Right. To do that. That's the strength of this protection. That's why groups like the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance work so hard year in and year out to see places like the fabulous wilderness in Doñana County down around Las Cruces. Given this former protection, hard as it may be to achieve that, then you've got the burden of proof being on someone that wants to make a change. But it has been done. I'm sure it will be done again in the future. The Arctic Wildlife Refuge is a different situation. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is 18 million acres in size. That's 9 Yellowstones with no roads at all. And about half of it, 9 million acres, is already designated as wilderness. So in addition to being a National Wildlife Refuge, that 9 million acres has this extra layer of protection. But that does not include the area of controversy for oil and gas leasing. When Congress made that wilderness designation in 1980, it wasn't possible. The House of Representatives made the whole area wilderness. But it wasn't possible to get the Senate to go along with that. So the way the situation was left, and a law passed in 1980, was that if there's to be any oil and gas drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, even for exploration, Congress has to pass a law to allow it. And despite the power of the oil and gas industry and the enthusiasm of some recent administrations to open the Arctic Coastal Plain, they've not been able to convince Congress, a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate. And we're hopeful that additional protections, including wilderness, can be achieved for that area under contention. Most of the rest of the Arctic slope is available for oil and gas leasing. Here is one place that started the commitment to protect it as an incredibly sensitive wildlife habitat for the many species. The caribou, most famously, was made starting with President Dwight Eisenhower when I was in grade school. It seems like all these years later, we can probably figure out that we can, in a world that needs to turn away from oil anyway, maybe we shouldn't sacrifice every place.
So it's interesting also that distinction between National Wildlife Refuge and wilderness. Wilderness is even stronger, designation.
It's that extra layer.
Yeah. We're talking to Doug Scott with the Campaign for America's Wilderness. So you've written several books, and we're talking about a couple of them today. One of them, your new book, is called Our Wilderness, America's Common Ground, with a foreword by Robert Redford. And it is a very pretty picture book that's available where? In national parks?
It was written, intended particularly for to reach people who visit national parks and national forests and our other public lands, and go into a visitor center or a ranger's office and walk into the area where they have books for sale, and where there simply hasn't been something that would introduce readers to our national wilderness system, the story of the Wilderness Act, and the story of the amazing story of the ordinary, everyday citizens who, out of love for some particular wild place, have taken up the issue of seeing that area preserved with the power of this law. It's basically a primer, attempting to, and the title was chosen very carefully, Our Wilderness, America's Common Ground. This is something we have to celebrate. It's a success of grassroots democracy. Again, every area protected in this wilderness system gets there only by act of Congress. And from the mayor of the small town in West Virginia to the hardware dealer from a little town in the mountains of northern Montana to the cocktail waitress at a casino in Nevada to the school nurse in northern along the coast of Northern California, these are people I know who have led campaigns that have taken them ultimately to the halls of Congress to see areas they know best and that they love, protected by the power of the Wilderness Act. Ordinary people, not fancy lobbyists, ordinary citizens who just love some landscape, like the good leaders so many people that I've met with in Las Cruces, who are working to see wilderness protected, hundreds of thousands of acres of wilderness that will be the essential outdoor setting for that fast-growing part of your state.
When an area is designated as wilderness, or when you have an area of public land that is wild, sometimes it needs not only preservation, but actual restoration. Give us some examples of lands where restoration is really crucial.
Well, there's many good examples. One that in the earliest days of my career in Washington, D.C. as a wilderness lobbyist, working for the Wilderness Society, I worked to help passed the legislation that protected a wilderness area 26 miles from Times Square in suburban New Jersey, in a little basin set in suburban New Jersey with called the Great Swamp, and had been threatened by airport development. And the local people raised the funds to purchase enough of the land and give it to the United States as a wildlife refuge, and then the idea of having the wilderness came along. And it was going to be a wilderness divided in two parts because there was an old road that completely bisected the refuge. And we're not talking about a large wilderness area, 3,700 acres total. In the congressional committee, as they held their hearing about this, the chairman of the committee in the House of Representatives said, "What's that line? What's that dividing this into two areas?" And somebody got up and said, "That's the Morristown Road." It was a two-lane, mostly gravel, but some paved, township road that was used by people to get across this swamp. It's now a delightful trail. After President Johnson signed the law in 1968 that made it the third area added to our wilderness system after the original Wilderness Act, it took about 3 years using heavy equipment to go in and take the road out. In the process, they plugged up some old drainage ditches that had been built, that had been dug before the Revolutionary War. This whole swamp had been settled, drained, settled, farmed, old farm fields. Unless you knew the story I just told you or were a superbly trained ecological observer, you could walk along that trail today, as I did fairly recently, and never know that 35 years ago it was road. That was an active restoration to remove something that allowed this better wilderness outcome. And there's lots of situations like that.
I can only imagine the city council meetings in which the people who drove their cars along that road were complaining about it.
They loved it. This was hugely popular.
Really?
There were 6,000 letters and statements submitted to the administrative hearing about this proposal at the outset. There was one opposed. the people from the township, the elected township supervisors, were in the room when that congressman raised the question. They were right up there saying, we'll have to go through some legal steps to legally abandon the road. And it had telephone poles down it. There was a house. So they had to, you know, buy the house and get rid of it. But this is now, it's a fabulous story. And this is just in the first 35 years. And if we're saving places like this as wilderness forever, this is a wilderness that's getting wilder and wilder in reach of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of our citizens. I hope they don't all go there at one time, but it's a delightful place.
Tell us how the Obama administration is dealing with questions of wilderness. I mean, in terms of supporting wilderness, it couldn't possibly be worse than the previous administration. How's Obama and his folks doing?
Well, let me put that.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Let me put that worse into context. And his two terms, President George W. Bush had the opportunity to sign 11 laws designating additional wilderness areas, about 2.5 million acres, including an area just about an hour's drive from my house in Seattle, in downtown Seattle, Washington, called the Wild Sky Wilderness. His administration testified for every acre of this area proposed by our members of Congress, took 6 years for a variety of reasons. The day that President Bush signed that law, I called up the Undersecretary of Agriculture, who'd been the witness supported it, to share my thanks with him. Now, he wasn't used to getting calls from people from the Green Lobby, but we had a very good conversation, and he later spoke at the dedication of the new wilderness area. So this is a program that has attracted support across political lines: conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat, urban, rural. The support is very strong. President Obama had the unusual chance to sign a law that designated 2 million acres of wilderness right in the early months of his administration. This was because this was a law that had been gummed up in the previous Congress and it took a lot of maneuvering, but it finally was into the new administration before it finally cleared Congress and came to his desk. We know this much, that the administration is still getting all of its personnel and its appointees in place. We know several things. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, came to Seattle a few weeks ago, and I attended a speech that he gave out in a park against a backdrop of lush Seattle-drenched trees. And he was announcing his vision for the national forests. And he made an extremely important announcement there. He said that the administration was going to go into court in the Court of Appeals in Denver to side with environmental groups and several states who have brought an appeal from a federal district court ruling in Wyoming that invalidated the protection of the roadless areas on the national forest. This has been a long-running controversy. Just at the end of his term of office, President Clinton promulgated this rule to protect the still roadless portions of the national forest. We've gone through a lot of ups and downs and ins and outs. A court in San Francisco has sustained the Clinton rule. The court in Wyoming has come out against it. But it was a huge, to those of us who work on these issues, it was a huge shot in the arm for the Obama administration to say, on behalf of the Justice Department, on behalf of the Obama administration, was going into court on the same side as citizen activists to see these roadless areas protected.
Doug Scott is Policy Director for the Campaign for America's Wilderness. He's the author of a couple of books, including The Enduring Wilderness and Our Wilderness, America's Common Ground. If people want to get in touch with you, what is the website for Campaign for America's Wilderness?
I'll give you two. To find out more about the books, go to ourwilderness.org.
Ourwilderness.org.
To find out about wilderness campaigns around the country, our website is leaveitwild.org.
Doug Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Mary.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website, santafe.radiocafe.org. You can hear the show there whenever you want. You can download it. You can put it on your iPod. You can do anything you want with it. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by the KSFR news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.